This is the voice of the Vortex. Hello. Today is January 25th, 2011. In the time between reading The 100,000 Kingdoms and the release of its sequel, The Broken Kingdoms, I convinced myself that I'd bought into the hype around N.K. Jemisin and her first series, The Inheritance Trilogy. Then, The Broken Kingdoms arrived, and I realized that I was wrong. These books are just that good. I think the confusion arises from the author's facility with language. These books are readable, which is easy to mistake for simple. The Broken Kingdoms is not simple. N.K. Jemisin's prose does not draw attention to itself, but it creates precisely the right mood from moment to moment. I like watching writers who have decided to challenge themselves. The first-person narrative that the author chose to use in this book must have been a challenge. Our heroine is a blind woman who ran away from home to live in the magical city called Sky by most of the world, but called Shadow by its inhabitants. She makes her living selling trinkets to the tourists until a god turns up dead in the next alley over. And, oh yes, her ex-boyfriend is a god too. Her housemate is something stranger, being mortal enough to die, but never for more than a day at a time. When we meet him, he has just bled out all over Ori's kitchen. The Broken Kingdoms deals with the consequences of the events in the 100,000 Kingdoms, but from a very different point of view. It examines the questions, what does it mean for a person to really change who they are? What does that take? The relationship between humans and gods, between lovers, between siblings, all pull this story into its final shape. Despite the elegance of N.K. Jemisin's writing, this was not an easy book to read on an emotional level. She does not shy away from hurting her characters, pushing them past the point where an ordinary person would lay down and die, and then telling them, "Get up. It all depends on you." Again, the first-person perspective of this book adds to its strength, as the reader is not spared a moment of the protagonist's suffering or her triumph. Because, somehow, it all does work out in the end. Like its predecessor, The Broken Kingdoms follows a single plot to a satisfying end. I imagine there will be a lot of hype around this book as well. James Nichol started a campaign to get it nominated for a Hugo months ago. Please don't let the enthusiasm of others put you off. This book really is that good. I finally saw The Voyage of the Dawn Treader the other day, and yeah, it was disappointing. It didn't benefit from being 3D. I find that 3D effects keep me from appreciating the entire picture on the screen, especially with the glasses that my local theater uses. They project a sort of silvery glare all around the edges of the screen. It's quite distracting. Back to the movie. The book didn't have much of an overarching plot, just, let's go see what's out there, and maybe rescue some guys. The evil green mist plot that was pasted on to the movie wasn't interesting, and led to the goofiest rally the troops speech that I have had the misfortune to sit through. Of course, they're all going to fight. They're on a boat. Where are they going to go? The only other option would be to mutiny against the man whom God explicitly and personally chose to be their king. That's not good odds. Still, the Dawn Treader was gorgeously made. The effects were excellent as always. The Duffelpuds got a cameo, and the boy they cast as Eustace was spot on. This is a movie for people who, like me, are in it for the nostalgia value, and want a mental image to replace the cardboard dragon from the BBC production. It's interesting to see how much of C.S. Lewis's proselytizing is left in the movie. This time, the answer was all of it, at least all that I remember, including the scene at the end where Aslan tells Lucy that he has another name in her world, that is, Jesus, and that she needs to learn to love him there, too. I am not used to being proselytized by my reading material, not from a religious point of view, anyway. Plenty of books have tried to sell their politics to me. I have a review up over at Escape Pod of the self-published urban fantasy novel Monster Hunter International. In summary, it's actually quite bad. It doesn't even make it to the bad writing but cool plot loophole that a lot of urban fantasy squeaks through. The complete review is at Escape Pod, but one thing I didn't mention there is the weird religious overtones in this book. The author is not trying to convert anyone, at least I don't think he is. However, the book is full of in-jokes and references that might have been intended to be subtle but aren't. For example, the only Mormon character is also the only character with enough faith to drive away a vampire. There's the wink-wink-nudge-nudge, gee, I wonder how the Assyrian artifact got to Central America, know what I mean, scene. And there are happy polygamist trolls. The usual Monster Hunter disclaimer applies, I am not kidding. TTA stands for The Third Alternative. The TTA Press podcast, Transmissions from Beyond, is one of the best fiction podcasts out there. It draws from the TTA Press magazines, Black Static for horror and Interzone for science fiction. Most of what they play seems to come from Black Static, and I am not a fan of horror, but the examples of the genre that are played on Transmissions from Beyond are well written enough that I don't mind listening to them. The last story they podcast was The Giving Plague by David Brin. First published in 1988, The Giving Plague is a classic science fiction short story about progress and free will that does not lose any of its power when read aloud. Another of their stories is one of the few I keep on my iPod for repeat listening, That Thing Over There by Dominic Green. It's narrated by the author, who is sometimes hard to understand, but his accent only enhances the overall experience. That Thing Over There is a story about the discovery of the Yeti and the consequences for the human race. My only complaint about Transmissions from Beyond is how rarely they update. As I've said before, I don't read physical magazines, not even the copy of Interzone that is still sitting on my desk. They publish some great stuff, though, and I hate to miss any of it. I have heard people say that there aren't enough podcasts dedicated to examining UFO claims. Well, there is a simple explanation for that. Most UFO claims rely on photographs, and it's hard to do them justice on a podcast. You can't even see me waving my hands. That's not to say that no one has tried. The Skeptoid has done a few good episodes about UFOs, most notably the one where the sightings sync up perfectly with a nearby lighthouse. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe has addressed UFOs a few times as well. I find the whole subject fascinating. I've seen UFOs. The one I remember most vividly was a boxy thing that I saw flying through a blue sky. It seemed to have something suspended below it that was flashing, like a reflector turning around and around in the sun. To this day, I have no idea what it was. I don't know how big it was, or how far away, or how fast it was flying. An empty blue sky has no landmarks to judge size or speed. The problem with UFOs originates, I think, in the unreliability of the human eye. Our eyes are balls of jelly with a spot of clear tissue on one end and a patch of light-sensitive tissue on the other. Muscles work to pull the tissues this way and that, projecting a tiny, blurry, upside-down image onto the light-sensing cells. Our brains handle the rest, processing that meager image into an entire world. In order to do that, our brains make assumptions about the way the world works. These assumptions, these leaps of logic, make us prone to making really exciting mistakes. Optical illusions are good examples of the kinds of mistakes our brains can make. I'll link to some of my favorites in the show notes. Another problem is the way memories play tricks on us. The brain is not a hard drive, and it does not pull up recordings of everything we've seen. In a way, our memories are stories that we are constantly telling ourselves. I no longer remember exactly what that object in the sky looked like. If I try to describe it now, I will probably be making up details to fill in the blank spots in my memory. The more I describe it, though, the more confident I will become. False memories are scarily easy to create, as I've mentioned before. One of the tricks of being a good skeptic is to avoid the twin fallacies of, I saw it, therefore it is real, and I remember it, therefore it happened. I don't really know what my UFO looked like, and I probably didn't have a good idea of what it looked like at the time. I will probably never know exactly what I saw. Becoming comfortable with that kind of uncertainty is one of the hardest parts of being a skeptic. The Voice of the Vortex is produced under a Creative Commons, Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works, Share Alike 3.0 license. To comment on this episode, or to submit flash fiction for future shows, drop an email to voiceofthevortex, all one word, @gmail.com. Show notes are available at voiceofthevortex.podbean.com. This is Sarah Frost, the Voice of the Vortex, signing off.